Side 4. Conan the Liberator by L. Sprague de Camp and Lynn Carter. Continuing on page 161. Her page's garb, tattered and torn, was gray with dust and caked with sun-dried mud. Her black hair formed a tangled web around a face stiff with soil and apprehension. She dragged weary feet, scarce able to support her drooping frame. The beautiful girl who had gallantly set off for Masantia now seemed a worn woman in the winter of her years.
"Alcina," cried the wizard, "whence come you? What brings you here?"
In a scarcely audible whisper, she replied,
"Master, may I sit? I am foredone."
"Be seated, then."
As Alcina sank down upon a marble bench and closed her eyes, Thulandra Thu projected his sibilant voice across the echoing chamber.
"Shall! Wine for Mistress Alcina! Now, good wench, relate all that has befallen you."
The girl drew a sobbing breath.
"I have been 8 days on the road, scarce halting to snatch a catnap and a bite to eat."
"Ah, so? And wherefore?"
"I came to say, to tell you, that Amulius Procas is dead."
"Good," said Thulandra Thu,
pinwheels of light dancing in his hooded eyes.
"But Conan lives."
At this astounding information, the sorcerer for the second time that day lost his composure.
"Satan Kali!" he cried. "How did that happen? Out with it, girl! Out with it!"
Before answering, Alcina paused to sip from the cup of saffron wine that Xiao handed her. Then, haltingly, she recounted her adventures in the camp of the Border Legion. How she stabbed Procas, how she learned that Conan lived, and how she escaped the guard.
"And so," she concluded, "fearing that you knew not of the barbarian's miraculous survival, I deemed it my duty to report to you forthwith."
Brows drawn in a ferocious frown, the sorcerer contemplated Alcina with his hypnotic gaze. Then he purred with the controlled rage of an angry feline.
"Instead of undertaking this weary journey, why did you not withdraw a prudent distance from the Legion's camp and commune with me at the appropriate hour by means of your fragment of yonder mirror?"
"I could not, master."
Alcina wrung her hands distractedly.
"Wherefore not?"
Thulandra Thu's voice suddenly jabbed like a thrown knife.
"Have you mislaid the table of positions of the planets with which I did supply you?"
"Nay, my lord, it's worse than that. I lost my fragment of the mirror. I lost my talisman."
Lips drawn back in a snarl, Thulandra uttered an ophidian hiss.
"By Nurgle's demons," he grated, "you little fool! What devil of carelessness possessed you? Are you mad? Or did you set your silly heart on some lusty lout, like unto a she-cat in heat? For this I will punish you in ways unknown to mortal men. I will not only flog your body, but flay your very soul. You shall live the pains of all your previous lives, from the first bit of protoplasmal slime up through the worm, the fish, and the ape. You shall beg me for death, but..."
"Pray, master, do but listen," cried Alcina, falling to her knees. "You know men's lusts mean naught to me, save as I rouse them in your service."
Weeping, she told of the death struggle in the dark with Amulius Procas, and of her later discovery of the loss of the talisman. Thulandra Thu bit his lip to master his rising wrath.
"I see," he said at length. "But when striking for great prizes, one cannot afford mistakes. Had your dagger traveled true, Procas would not have lingered long enough to seize your amulet."
"I knew not that he wore a shirt of mail beneath his tunic. Can you not cut another fragment from the master mirror?"
"I could, but the enchantment of the fragment for transmitting distant messages is such a tedious process that the war were over ere it was completed."
Thulandra Thu stroked his sharp chin.
"Did you make certain of Procas's death?"
"Yes. I felt his pulse and listened for his heartbeat."
Aye, but you did not so with the Cimmerian. That was the greater error.
Alcina made a gesture of despair. I served him with sufficient poison to have slain 2 ordinary men. But betwixt his great size and the unnatural vitality that propelled him... She drooped abjectly at her master's feet and let her voice trail off. Thulandra Thul rose, and towering above the trembling girl, pointed a skinny forefinger towards heaven.
Father Set, can none of my servants carry out my simplest demand?
Then, turning his sudden anger on the huddled girl, he added,
Little idiot, will you feed a boarhound on a lapdog's rations?
Master, you warned me not. And who am I to calculate the grains of lotus venom needed for a giant? Alcina's voice rose, and fury rode upon it. You sit in comfort in your palace, whilst this poor servant courses the countryside in good and evil weather, risking her skin to do your desperate deeds, and not a kindly word have you to offer her.
Thulandra Thul spread his arms wide, palms upturned in a gesture of forgiveness.
Now, now, my dear Alcina, let us speak no ill of one another. When allies part, the enemy wins the battle by default. If I ask you to poison another of my foes, I'll send along a clerk skilled in reckoning to calculate the dose.
He seated himself with a thin and rueful smile.
Truly, the gods must laugh like fiends at the irony of it. Having sent Amulius Procus to whatever nether world the fates decreed, I earnestly wish that the old ruffian were alive again. For on none but him can I rely to defeat the barbarian and his rebel following. I thought that Escalante and Grommel could together thwart the insurgents' efforts to cross the Alamein, and so they could have, were not Conan in command. Now I must find an abler general for the Border Legion. This needs some thinking on. Count Ulrich of Rahman has the army of the North in Gunderland watching the Cimmerians. An able commander, he. But the moon must wax and wane ere he receives an order and rides the length of Aquilonia. Prince Numitor lies closer on the Pictish frontier, but...
Xiao's tactful knock echoed like a tiny brazen bell. Entering, he said, A pigeon-borne dispatch from Masantia, Master, newly received by Vibius Lotro. Bowing, he handed the small scroll to the wizard. Thulandra Thul rose and held the scroll close to one of the huge candles, and reading, pressed his lips together until his mouth became a thin slit in his dusky face. At last he said,
Well, Mistress Alcina, it seems the gods of my far-distant island are careless of the welfare of their favored child.
What has befallen now? Asked Alcina, rising to her feet.
Prince Cassio, quoth Thaddeus, has sent a messenger from the Rhaebarian mountains back to his sire in Masantia. Conan, it seems, fully recovered from an illness that struck him down, has crossed the Alamein, and with the aid of Poitanian lords and peasants has utterly destroyed the Border Legion. Senior Captain Grommel and his men have deserted to the rebels. Escalante may have fled, for neither he nor his exanimate body can be found.
The wizard crumpled the missive and glared at Alcina, and the eyes he fixed upon her burned red with a rage such as she had never seen in any living eyes.
He snarled, The times you tempt me, wench, to snuff out your miserable life as a man extinguishes a lighted candle. I have a silent spell that turns mine enemy into a petty pile of ashes with never a flame nor a plume of smoke.
Alcina shrank away and crossed her arms upon her breast, but there was no escape from the sorcerer's hypnotic stare. Her body burned as from the licking tongues of flame that lapped the open door of a furnace. The magical emanations pierced her inmost being, and she closed her eyes as if to shut out the cruel radiations. When she opened them once more, she threw up her hands to ward off a blow and shrieked hysterically. Where the sorcerer had stood now reared a monstrous serpent.
From its upraised head, swaying on a level with her own, slit-pupiled eyes poured maleficent rays into her soul, while a reptilian stench inflamed her nostrils. The scaly jaws gaped wide, revealing a pair of dagger-pointed fangs as the great head lunged towards her. Flinching, she blinked again, and when she ventured to open her eyes, it was Thulandra Thu who stood before her. With a crooked smile on his narrow face, the wizard said, "Fear not, girl. I do not wantonly blunt my tools whilst they still possess a cutting edge." Still shuddering, Alcina recovered herself enough to ask, Did you in truth take the form of a serpent, master? Or did you but cast an image of reality upon me?" Thulandra Thu evaded her question. "I did but remind you which of us is master here and which apprentice." Alcina was content to change the subject. Pointing to the crumpled parchment, she asked, "How came Thaddeus by Prince Cassio's information?" "Milo of Argos declared a public celebration, and the reason was no secret. It is plain which side the old fool favors. And one item more. Milo ordered that clodpate Quesado banished from his kingdom, and our would-be diplomat was last seen traveling with an escort of Milo's household guard along the road to Aquilonia. I shall urge Phibius Lotro to set the fellow working as a collector of offal. He is good for nothing else. And now, perhaps our meddlesome mad king will leave affairs of state to me, and confine himself to his besotted pleasures. I must ponder my next move in this board game with fate, wherein a kingdom is the prize. And so, Alcina, you have my leave to go. Xiao will provide you with food, drink, a much-needed bath, and woman's raiment." The league-long glittering river that was the Army of Liberation wound around tree-crowned hills, past fields and steads, and up to the gates of Kulario. Conan, in the lead, reined in his black stallion at the sight of the gaping opening. From the gate towers flapped flags bearing the crimson leopards of Poitain. But the black heraldic eagle of Aquilonia was nowhere to be seen. Inside the city walls, people lined both sides of the narrow street. In Conan's agile mind stirred the barbarian suspicion of the trickery of civilized men. Turning to Trocero, who rode a white gelding at his side, Conan muttered, "You're certain it's not a royalist trap they've set for us?" "My head on it," replied the count fervently. "I know my people well." Conan studied the scene before him and rasped, "Methinks I'd best not look too much the conqueror. Wait a little." He unbuckled the chin strap of his helmet, pulled off the headpiece, and hung it on the pommel of his saddle. Then he dismounted with a clank of armor and strode towards the gate on foot, leading his horse. Thus Conan the Liberator entered unpretentiously into Kulario, nodding gravely to the citizens ranked on either side. Petals of fragrant flowers showered upon him. Cheers resounded down the winding corridor. Following him on horseback, Prospero pulled to Trocero and whispered in his comrade's ear, "Were we not fools the other night to wonder who should succeed Numenides?" Count Trocero replied with a wry smile and a shrug of his iron-clad shoulders as he raised a hand in salutation to his fond and loyal subjects. In his sanctum, Thulandra Thu bent over a map, unrolled upon a tabouret with weights of precious metals holding its edges down. He addressed himself to Alcina, now well rested from her journey and resplendent in a flowing robe of yellow satin which clung to her fine molded body and glorified her raven hair. "One of Latro's spies reports that Conan and his army are in Kulario, resting from their battle and forced march. In time, they will strike north, following the Korotas to Tarantia." He pointed with a long, well-paired fingernail. "The place to stop them is at the Imerian escarpment in Poitain, which lies athwart their path. The only force that has both weight and time enough to accomplish such a task is Prince Numitor's royal frontiersmen,
based at Fort Thandara in the western mark of Mausonia. Alcina peered at the map and said, "Then should you not order Prince Numitor to march southeast with all dispatch, taking all but a small garrison?" The wizard chuckled dryly. "We shall make a general of you yet, good wench." The rider bearing that message in his pouch set off ere dawn. Thulandrothu then measured off distances with his fingers, rotating his hand as if it were a draftsman's compass. "But, as you see, if Conan marches within the next 2 days, Numitor can in no way reach the escarpment in advance of him. We must cause him to delay."
"Yes, master, but how?
I am not unacquainted with weather magic, and can control the spirits of the air. I shall contrive a scheme to hold the Cimmerian in Kulario. Fetch hither yonder powders and potions, girl, and we shall test the power of my wizardry."
Conan stood on the city wall beside the newly elected mayor of Kulario. The day had been fair when they began their promenade, but now they gazed at an indigo sky across which clouds of leaden gray rolled in endless procession.
"I like it not, sir," said the mayor. "The summer has been wet, and this looks like the start of another spell. Too much rain can be as bad for the crops as none at all. And here it comes," he finished, wiping a large drop from his forehead.
As the two men descended the spiral stair that wound around the tower, an agitated Prospero confronted them.
"General," he cried, "you slipped away from your bodyguard again."
"By Crom, I like to get off by myself sometimes," growled Conan. "I need no nursemaid looking after me."
"It is the price of power, general," said Prospero.
"More than our leader, you have become our symbol and our inspiration. We must guard you as we would our banner or another sacred relic. For if the enemy could strike you down, his fight were 3/4 won. I assure you, spies of Vibius Lotro lurk in Kulario, watching for a chance to slip a poison into your wine or a poniard between your ribs."
"Those vermin," snorted Conan. "Aye, but you can die from such a creature's sting as readily as any common man. Thus, general, we have no choice but to cosset you as carefully as a newborn prince. These trifling inconveniences you must learn to endure."
Conan heaved a gusty sigh.
"There's much to be said for the life of a footloose wanderer, such as once I was. Let's back to the governor's palace ere this cloudburst wash us all away."
Conan and Prospero strode swiftly over the cobblestones, the stout mayor panting to keep pace. Overhead, a meandering crack of violet light cleft the sky, and thunder crashed like the roll of a thousand drums. The rain came down in sheets. Chapter 9. The Iron Stallion. While Poitain writhed beneath the lash of the most violent storm in the memory of living men, a benign sun smiled on fair Tarantia. Standing in its salubrious rays on a palace balcony, Thulandrothu, attended by Alcina and Xiao, looked out across the gently rolling fields of central Aquilonia, where summer wheat was ripening into spears of gold. To the dancer, now young and beautiful once more, with jewels a-twinkle in her night-black hair and a gown of clinging satin sheathing her shapely form, the wizard said, "The wheel of heaven reveals to me that the spirits of the air have served me well. My storm progresses apace, and after it subsides, the southern roads and every ford will be impassable. Numitor hastens from the Westermark, and I must forth to join him."
Alcina stared. "You mean to travel to the field of battle, master? Ishtar, that's not your wont. May I ask why?"
"Numitor will be outnumbered by the rebel forces, and despite forced marches, Ulric of Ramon cannot reach Poitain until at least a fortnight after the prince arrives. Moreover, Prince Numitor is but an honest blockhead, doubtless the reason why our knavish king has let his cousin live when he has slain or exiled all his other kin. Nay, I cannot trust the prince to hold the Imerian escarpment until Count Ulric arrives, You will require the assistance of my arcane arts.
The sorcerer turned to his servant, the inscrutable slit-eyed one who had followed him from lands beyond the seas.
Shall prepare my chariot and gather the necessaries for our journey. We shall depart upon the morrow.
Bowing, the man withdrew. Turning to Alcina, Thulandrathu continued,
Since the spirits of the air have well obeyed me, I shall discover what the spirits of the earth will do to aid my cause. And you, good wench, I leave here as my deputy.
Me? No, master. I lack the skills to take your place.
I will instruct you. First, you will learn to use the Mirror of Tamesu to commune with me.
But we are without the necessary talisman.
I can project images by the propellant power of my mind, though you could not. Come, we have no time to waste.
From the royal paddocks, Xiao led out the single horse that drew his master's carriage. To a casual observer, the animal appeared to be a large black stallion, but a closer inspection of its hide revealed a strange metallic sheen. The beast, moreover, neither pawed the ground nor lashed its tail at flies. In fact, no flies alighted on it, although the stable yard buzzed with their myriad wings. The stallion stood quiescent until Xiao uttered a command unintelligible to any who might hear it. Then the creature obeyed him instantly. Xiao now led the ebon stallion to the carriage house and backed it into the stall where stood Thulandra's chariot. When a careless hoof struck against one of the lowered carriage shafts, a metallic ring reverberated through the silent air. The vehicle, a box-like two-wheeled cart, lacquered in vermilion and emblazed with a frieze of writhing serpents worked in gold, was furnished with a seat across the back. A pair of carven posts, upthrust on either side, supported an arched wooden frame, covered with canvas. No ordinary cover, this. It was embroidered with strange symbols beyond the ken of all who gazed upon it, save that the astute among them might discern the likeness of the moon and the major constellations of the southern hemisphere. Into the chest beneath the seat of this singular vehicle, Xiao placed all manner of supplies, and on the broad expanse above he piled silken cushions in profusion. And as he worked, he hummed a plaintive song of Kitai, full of curious quarter tones. Conan and Trocero watched the sheeting rain from the governor's mansion. At length, Conan growled,
I knew not that your country lay at the bottom of an inland sea, my lord.
The count shook his head.
Never in half a century of living have I seen a storm of such intensity. Not but sorcery could account for it.
Thank you, Thulandrathu, Conan clapped his companion on the shoulder.
You Aquilonians see magic lurking in every passing shadow. If you stub your toe, it's Thulandra's doing. In my dealings with these wizards, I've seldom found them so formidable as they would wish us to believe. Aye, Prospero, he added, as the officer bustled in. The scouts have returned, General, and report all roads are utterly impassable. Even the smallest creeks are bursting into raging torrents. It were useless to send the column forward. They'd not advance a league beyond the city.
Conan cursed.
Your suspicion of that he-witch in Tarantia begins to carry weight, Trocero. And we have visitors, continued Prospero. The northern barons who set out for home before we reached Kulario have been overtaken by the storm and forced to return hither.
A smile illumined Conan's dark, scarred face.
Thank Crom, good news at last. Show them in.
Prospero ushered in five men in damp woolen traveling garments of good quality, mud-splattered from top to booted toe. Trocero presented the Baron Roaldo of Imeris, whose domain lay in northern Poitine. A former officer in the royal army, this hardy, gray-haired noble had guided the other barons and their escorts to Kulario and now introduced them to the Sumerian.
Conan judged the lordlings to be men of divers characters. One stout, red-faced, and full of boisterous good humor, another slim and elegant, still another fat and obviously privy to the pleasures of the table and the jug, and two of somber mien and given to few words. Differing though they did among themselves, all heartily supported the rebellion, for their tempers were rubbed raw by Numedides's grasping tax collectors, and their ancient pride affronted by the royal troops stationed on their domains to wrest a yearly tribute from landowner and peasant. They avidly desired the downfall of the tyrant, and their questing gaze sought to discover Numedides's successor, so they might court their future monarch's favor. After the barons had rested and donned fresh raiment, Conan and his friends heard their tally of complaints and drew out their hidden hopes. Conan promised little, but his sympathetic demeanor left each with the impression that in a new regime he would occupy a position of importance. "Be warned, my lord," said Conan. "Ulrich, Count of Ramon, will move his troops across your lands as he travels south to confront our rebel army." "What troops does that gray-haired count command?" snorted Baron Roaldo. "A ragtail lot, I'll warrant. The Sumerian frontier has long been peaceful and needs but a weak force to keep it safe." "Not so," replied the Count of Poitain. "I am informed that the Army of the North is nearly up to strength, and boasts veterans of many a border clash. Indeed, Ramon himself is a master strategist who escaped from the sack of Venarium many years ago." Conan smiled grimly. As a stripling, he had joined the wild Sumerian horde that plundered Fort Venarium, but of this he made no mention. Instead, he told the northern barons, "Numedides will, I doubt not, send troops from the Westermark, and being nearer, they will arrive the sooner. You must harry these northern contingents in a delaying action, at least until we rout the Bossonian royalists." Count Trocero eyed the barons keenly. "Canst raise a fighting force without alerting the king's men stationed amongst you?" said Baron Amion of Ronda. "Those human grasshoppers swarm only at harvest time to consume the fruit of our labors. They'll not arrive, the gods willing, for another month or two." "But," argued the fat Baron Justin of Armavir, "such a conflict waged on our lands will ruin both our purses and our people. Perchance we can delay Sir Ulrich, but only till he burns our fields, scatters our folk, and wreaks vengeance on our persons." "If General Conan fails to take Tarantia, we are beggared in any case," countered the hard-featured Roaldo. "Word will soon reach the tyrant spies that we have joined the rebel cause. Better to game for a golden eagle than for a copper penny." "He speaks sooth," said Amion of Ronda. "Unless we topple the tyrant, we shall all have our necks either lengthened or shortened, no matter what we do. So let us dare the hazard, and from encompassing dangers boldly pluck our safety." At last the five agreed, some with enthusiasm, others doubtfully. And so it was decided that as soon as the weather cleared, the barons would hasten northward to their baronies, like chaff blown before an oncoming storm, to harass Count Ulrich's army of the north when it sought passage through their property. After the barons had retired for the night, Prospero asked Conan, "Think you they will arrive in time?" "For that matter," added Trocero, "will they hold true to their new alliance if Numedides strews our path with steel, or if Tarantia stands firm against us?" Conan shrugged. "I am no prophet. The gods alone can read the hearts of men." The sorcerer's chariot rumbled through the streets of Tarantia, with Xiao, legs braced against the floorboards, gripping the reins, and Thulandra Thu in hooded cloak seated on the pillow-padded bench. Citizens who remarked the vehicle's approach turned away their faces. To meet the dark sorcerer's eyes might focus his attention, and all deemed it expedient to escape the magician's notice. For none there was who failed to hear rumors of his black experiments and tales of missing maidens. The great bronze portals of the south gate swung open at the vehicle's approach and closed behind it.
Along the open country road, the strange steed paced at twice the speed of ordinary horse flesh, while the chariot bounced and swayed, trailing a thin plume of dust. More than 40 leagues of white road unrolled with every passing day, and neither heat nor rain nor gloom of night stayed the iron stallion from its appointed task. When Xiao wearied, his master grasped the reins. During these periods of rest, the yellow man devoured cold meats and snatched a spell of fitful sleep. Whether his master ever closed his eyes, Xiao knew not. After following the east bank of the river Korotas for several days, Thulandra Thu's chariot neared the great bridge that King Valerius I had flung across the river. Here, the road of kings, after swinging around two serpentine bends in the river, rejoined the stream and promptly crossed it to the western bank. The bridge, upraised on 6 stone piers that towered up from the riverbed, was furnished with a wooden deck and a steeply sloping ramp on either end. At the sight of the emblazoned chariot, the toll-taker bowed low and waved the carriage through, and as the vehicle ascended to the deck, Thulandra scanned the countryside. When he perceived a cloud of dust swirling aloft from the road ahead, a meager smile of satisfaction creased his saturnine visage. If the pounding hooves of Prince Numitor's cavalry roiled the loose soil and bore it skyward, his careful calculations of time and distance had been correct. They would meet where the Bossonian road conjoined with the highway to Poitain. The chariot thundered down the western ramp and continued southward, and within the hour Thulandra overtook a column of horsemen. As the painted chariot neared, a trooper at the column's tail recognized the vehicle. When word ran up the ranks, the cavalrymen hastily pulled their mounts aside, leaving an unobstructed path for the royal sorcerer. The horses shied and danced as the black metallic steed sped past, and the milling remounts and frightened pack animals reared and plunged and much discomfited their handlers. At the head of the column, the magician found Prince Numitor astride a massive gelding. Like his royal cousin, the king, the prince was a man of heavy build, with a reddish tinge to hair and beard. Otherwise, he presented quite a different aspect. Guileless blue eyes graced a broad-browed, sun-browned face that bore the stamp of easy-going geniality. "Why, Mage Thulandra!" exclaimed Numitor in amazement, when Xiao reined in his singular steed. "What brings you hither? Do you bear some urgent message from the king?"
"Prince Numitor, you will require my sorcerous arts to check the rebels' northward march."
The prince's eyes clouded with perplexity.
"I like not magic in my warfare. It's not a manly way to fight. But if my royal cousin sent you, I must make the best of it."
A glint of malice flared up in the sorcerer's hooded eyes.
"I speak for the true ruler of Aquilonia," he said, "and my commands must be obeyed. If we proceed with haste, we can reach the Imerian escarpment before the rebels. Are these two regiments of horse all that you bring with you?"
"Nay, 4 regiments of foot follow. They have not yet reached the junction of the Bossonian road with this."
"None too many, although we face naught but a rabble of undisciplined rogues. If we can hold them below the cliff wall until Count Ulrich arrives, we shall pluck their fangs. When we attain the crest of the escarpment, I wish you to detail 5 of your men, experienced hunters all, for a certain task."
"What task is that, sir?"
"Of this I shall inform you later. Suffice it to say that skilled woodsmen are necessary to the spell I have in mind."
At last, the rain ceased in Kulario. The northern barons and their entourage slogged along the muddy road, where vapor steamed from puddles drying in the summer sun. Shortly thereafter, the Army of Liberation set out upon the same highway, leading northward to the central provinces, and thence to proud Tarantia on the far bank of the Korotas. At every town and hamlet that they passed, the legions of the Liberator were infused with new recruits. Old knights eager to take part in one last glorious affray, battle-battered ex-soldiers who had served with Conan on the Pictish frontier, lean foresters and huntsmen
who saw in Conan a nature lover like themselves. Outlaws and exiles, drawn by the promise of amnesty for those who fought beneath the Golden Lion. Yeomen, tradesmen, and mechanics. Woodcutters, charcoal burners, smiths, masons, pavers, weavers, fullers, minstrels, clerks. All hard-eyed men eager to adventure in the army of the Liberator. They so drained the armory of weapons that Conan at last insisted each recruit come already armed, if only with a woodsman's axe. Conan and his officers plunged into the arduous task of welding these eager volunteers into some semblance of a military force. They told the men off into squads and companies, and appointed sergeants and captains from those experienced in war. During halts, these new officers exercised their road-weary men in simple drills. For as Conan warned them, without constant practice, a horde of raw recruits like these dissolve into a mass of shrieking fugitives when the first blood is shed. Between the farmlands of southern Poitain and the Imerian escarpment stretched the great Broselian forest, through which the highway glided like a serpent amid a bed of ferns. As the rebels neared the forest, the songs of the Poitainian volunteers diminished. More and more, Conan noted, the recruits tramped along in glum silence, apprehensively eyeing the overarching foliage. "What ails them?" Conan asked Prosero as they sat of an evening in the command tent. "Anyone would think these woods writhed with venomous serpents." The gray-haired count smiled indulgently. "We have only the common viper and Poitain, and few of those. But the folk hereabouts are full of peasant superstitions, holding the forest to harbor supernatural beings who may work magic on them. Such beliefs are not without advantage. They preserve a splendid hunting ground for my barons and my friends." Conan grunted. "Once we scale the escarpment and gain the Imerian plateau, they'll doubtless find some new hobgoblin to obsess them. I have not seen this part of Aquilonia before, but by my reckoning, the cliff wall rises less than a day's march ahead. How runs the pass to the plateau?" "There's a deep cleft in the cliff where the turbulent Bitaxa River, a tributary of the Alamein, cascades across the wall of rock. The road winding upward to the plateau is borne upon a rock ledge thrust out from one side of the cleft. The gorge below, which we call the Giant's Notch, is slippery, steep, and narrow. An evil place to meet a cliff-top foe. Pray to your Crom that Numitor's frontiersmen do not reach the notch ahead of us." "Crom cares but little for the prayers of men," said Conan, "or so they told me when I was a boy. He breathes into each mortal man the strength to face his enemies, and that's all a man can reasonably ask of gods who have their own concerns. But we must not risk attack in this murderous trap. Tomorrow at dawn, take a strong party of mounted scouts to reconnoiter the escarpment." Publius waddled in, arms full of ledgers, and Prosero left Conan studying the inventory of supplies. The count sought out the tents of his Poitainian horsemen and chose from amongst them 40 skilled swordsmen for the morrow's reconnaissance. The Giant's Notch loomed high above Trosero's company, its beetling cliffs hiding black wells of darkness from the midday sun. The count and his scouts sat their saddles, staring upward at the crest, searching in vain for the telltale sparkle of sunlight on armor. Neither could they observe upon the elevation the smoke of any campfires. At length Trosero said, "We shall circle round the woods and meet again upon the road, a quarter league back, where a high rock ledge overhangs the forest path. Vopisco, take your half of the detachment east and meet me thither within the hour. I shall go westward." The detachment divided, and the horsemen forced their mounts through the dense foliage that spilled out into the road. Once past this obstacle, they encountered little underbrush beneath the thick trunks of the virgin oaks. For a short while, Trosero's party rode in silence, their horses' hooves soundless on the thick carpet of moldering leaves. Suddenly, the forester in the lead flung up a hand, turned in his saddle, and murmured, "Men ahead, my lord. Mounted, I think." The troop drew together, the men tense and apprehensive, their horses motionless. Through the shadowed ranks of trees, Trocero's eyes detected a disquieting movement. His ears a mutter of strange voices.
"Swords," whispered the Count, "prepare to charge, but strike not till I command. We know not whether they be friend or foe."
20 swords hissed from their scabbards as the riders eased their beasts to right or left until they formed a line among the trees. The voices waxed louder, and a group of horsemen sprang into view beyond the rugged boles of immemorial oaks. His upraised sword, a pointing finger, Trocero signaled the attack. Weaving around the trees, the score of Poitanians rode at the strangers. In a few heartbeats, they came within plain sight of them.
"Yield!"
shouted Trocero, then reined his horse in blank amazement. The animal reared, eyes rolling, forelegs pawing the insubstantial air. 5 mounted men, unarmored but wearing white surcoats adorned with the black eagle of Aquilonia, paused to stare. All but one led captive creatures by cruel ropes noosed tightly about their necks. The captives, 3 males and a female, were no larger than half-grown children, their nakedness partly veiled by a thin coat of fawn-like light brown fur. Above each snub-nosed humanoid face rose a pair of pointed ears. When their captors dropped the leashing ropes to draw their swords, and the freed creatures turned to run, Trocero saw each bore a short furry tail, like that of a deer, white on the underside. The leader of the Aquilonians, recovering his composure, shouted an order to his men. Instantly they spurred their mounts and charged.
"Kill them!" cried Trocero.
As the 5 royalists, bending low over their horses' necks, pounded towards the Poitanians, death rolled in their grim eyes. The rebel swordsmen could not present a solid line, spread out as they were among the trees, so the Aquilonians aimed for the gaps. The leader rode at Trocero, his blade thrust outward like a lance. To right and left, the Count's men, avenging furies, rushed headlong at the foe. There was an instant of wild confusion, raked by shouts and illumined by the white light of terror in the eyes of men flogged by the fury of their desperation. 2 troopers converged upon a galloping Aquilonian whose upraised sword whirled murderously above his tousled head. 1 drove his steel into the soldier's sword arm. The other struck downward with all his might, tearing a long gash in the speeding horse's side. But the screaming animal pressed forward, and the man ran free. A rebel sword darted past a blade that sought to slash him, and sheathed 6 inches of its point into an eagle-emblemed midriff. The lean, muscle-knotted Aquilonian leader lunged at Trocero, who parried with a clang, and the hum of steel on steel was a song of death. Then the 5 horses were through and away, like autumn leaves in a gale, with 4 of their riders. The 5th lay supine on the leaf mold of the forest floor, with a bloodstain spreading slowly across his white surcoat.
"Gremio!" shouted the Count. "Take your squad and pursue! Try to capture one alive!"
Trocero turned back to the trampled turf, which bore mute testimony to the furious encounter. Spying the fallen man, he said,
"Sergeant, see if that fellow lives."
As the sergeant dismounted, another trooper said,
"Please, my lord, he spitted himself on my steel as he rode past. I know he's dead."
"He is?"
nodded the sergeant after a quick examination. Trocero cursed.
"We needed him for questioning."
"Here's one of their captives," said the sergeant, kneeling beside the nude creature, flung like a discarded garment against a fallen log. "Methinks it was knocked down by a flying hoof and stunned in the melee."
Trocero bit his underlip in thought.
"It is, I do believe, a fabled satyr, whereof the country folk tell fearsome old wives' tales."
A look of superstitious terror crossed the sergeant's face, and he snatched back his questing hands.
"What shall I do with it, sir?"
he said, rising and stepping backward. The satyr, whose wrists were bound together by a narrow thong, opened its eyes, perceived the ring of hostile mounted men, and scrambled to its feet. Trembling, it sought to run, but the sergeant, grabbing the rope that trailed from its neck, tugged and brought it down. When it had been subdued, Trocero addressed it.
"Creature, can you talk?"
"Aye,"
the captive said in broken Aquilonian.
"Talk good. Talk my tongue. Talk little yours. What you do to me?"
That's for our general to decide, replied Trosero.
You no cut throat, like other men?
I have no wish to cut your throat. Why think you that those others so would do?
Others catch us for magic sacrifice.
The Count grunted, I see. You need fear naught of that from us. But we must bring you back to camp. Have you a name?
Me Gola,
said the satyr in his gentle voice.
Then, Gola, you shall ride pillion behind one of my men. Do you understand?
The satyr looked downcast.
Me fear horse.
You must overcome your fear, said Trosero, giving his sergeant a signal.
Up you go, said the soldier, swinging the small form aloft. And lifting the noose from Gola's neck, he bound the rope firmly about the satyr's waist and that of the trooper on whose horse the creature sat.
You'll be quite safe, he laughed.
Swinging into his saddle, he turned the column around. The squad, sent in pursuit of the royalists, arrived at the base of the Giant's Notch in time to see the fugitives disappear up the steep tunnel of the gorge. Fearing ambush, the Poitanians pressed the pursuit no further. Later, in the command tent, Trosero reported on his mission to the assembled leaders of the rebellion. Conan surveyed the captive and said,
That binding on your wrist seems tight, friend Gola. We need it not.
He drew his dagger and approached the satyr, who cringed and screamed in mortal terror,
No cutthroat! Man promised no cutthroat!
Forget your precious throat, growled Conan, seizing the captive's wrists in one gigantic hand. I would not harm you.
He slashed the thong and sheathed his poniard, while Gola flexed his fingers and winced at the pain of returning circulation.
That's better, eh? Said Conan, seating himself at the trestle table and beckoning the satyr to join him. Do you like wine, Gola?
The satyr smiled and nodded, and Conan signaled to his squire.
General, exclaimed Publius, holding up a finger to stay the execution of the order, our wine is nearly gone. A few flagons more and we're all back on beer.
No matter, said Conan, wine we shall have. The Nemedians have a saying, in wine is truth, and this I am about to test.
Publius, Trosero, and Prospero exchanged glances. Since he first clapped eyes upon the satyr, Conan displayed a curious affinity for this subhuman being. It was as if a scarce-tamed creature of the wild himself, he felt instinctive sympathy for another child of nature, dragged from its native haunts by civilized men whose ways and motives must be utterly incomprehensible. Half a wineskin later, Conan discovered that two regiments of royalist cavalry held the plateau above the Imerian escarpment. They were encamped not at the cliff top where they could attack if the rebels ascended the flume of the Giant's Notch, but several bowshots perhaps a quarter league back from the edge. And for several days, royalist hunting parties had clambered down the notch to sweep the neighboring woods for satyrs. Those they caught, they dragged alive back to their camp and penned them, still bound, in a stockade built for the purpose.
My folk move from notch, said Gola, sadly. Had no pipes ready?
Ignoring that strange remark, Conan asked.
How know you that they plan to use your people's blood for magical sacrifices?
The satyr gave Conan a sly, sidelong glance.
We know. We too have magic. Big magician on cliffs above.
Conan pondered, studying the small creature intently.
Gola, if we push the bad men from the upper plain, you need no longer fear mistreatment. If you help us, we will restore your woods to you.
How know I what big men do?
Big men kill our people? Nay, we are your friends. See, you are free to go.
Conan pointed to the tent flap, arms spread wide. A glow of childlike joy suffused the satyr's face. Conan waited for the glow to fade, then said,
Now that we've saved some of your folk from the wizard's cauldron, we may ask help from you. How can I reach you?
Gola showed Conan a small tube made of bone that was suspended from a vine entwined about his neck.
Go in woods and blow.
The satyr put the whistle to his lips and puffed his cheeks.
"I hear no sound," said Conan.
"Nay, but satyr here. You take."
Conan stared at the tiny whistle as it lay in his huge palm, while the others frowned, thinking the bit of bone a useless toy intended to cozen their general. Presently, Conan slipped the whistle into his pouch, saying gravely,
"I thank you, little friend."
Then, calling his squires and the nearest sentry, he said,
"Escort Gola into the woods beyond the camp. Let none molest him. Some of our superstitious soldiers might deem him an embodied evil spirit and take a cut at him. Farewell."
When the satyr had departed, Conan addressed his comrades.
"Numitor lies beyond the notch, waiting for us to climb the slope ere he signals attack. What make you of it?"
Prospero shrugged.
"He seems he relies much on that big magician, the king's sorcerer, I have no doubt."
Trocero shook his head.
"More likely, he's fain to give us a clear path to the top, so that we can face him on equal terms. He is a well-meaning gentleman who thinks to fight a war by rules of chivalry."
"He must know we outnumber him," said Publius, perplexed.
"Aye," retorted Trocero, "but his troops are Aquilonia's best, whereas half our motley horde are babes playing at warfare. So he relies on dash and discipline."
The argument was long and inconclusive. As twilight deepened into night, Conan banged his goblet on the table.
"We cannot sit below the cliffs for A, attempting to read Numitor's mind. Tomorrow we shall scale the giant's notch, prepared for instant action."
Chapter 10 Satyr's Blood. Prince Numitor paced restlessly about the royalist camp. The cooking fires were dying down, and the regiments of royal frontiersmen had turned in for the night. The new moon set, and in the gathering darkness the stars wheeled slowly westward, like diamonds stitched upon the night-blue cloak of a dancing girl. To the west, where twilight lingered, the dodging shape of a foraging bat besmudged the horizon, while overhead the clap of a nightjar's wings shattered the silence. The prince passed the line of sentries and strolled towards the edge of the escarpment, where Thulandra Thu had placed things needful for his magic. Behind him, the camp vanished into forest-shadowed darkness. Ahead, the precipice fell sharply away, and leftward yawned the black canyon that was called the Giant's Notch. Although the prince's placid ears picked up no sound of movement in the gorge, something about the camp's location disturbed him. But for a time, he could not put a finger on the source of his unease. After walking several bowshots distance, Prince Numitor sighted the dancing flames of a small fire. He hastened towards it. Thulandra Thu, hooded and cloaked in black like some bird of ill omen, was bending over the fire, while Xiao, on his knees, fed the blaze with twigs. A metal tripod, from the apex of which a small brazen pot was suspended by a chain, straddled the fickle fire. To one side, a large copper cauldron squatted in the grass. As Numitor approached, the sorcerer moved away from the firelight, and, fumbling in a leathern wallet, extracted a crystal phial. This he unstoppered, muttering an incantation in an unknown tongue, and poured the contents into the heated vessel. A sudden hissing and a plume of smoke shot through with rainbow hues issued from the pot. Thulandra Thu glanced at the prince, said a brief,
"Good even, my lord,"
and reached again into his wallet.
"Master Thulandra," said Numitor.
"Sir?"
The sorcerer paused in his searching.
"You insisted that the camp be set far from the precipice. I wonder at your reasoning. Should the rebels steal into the giant's notch, they would be upon us ere they were discovered. Why not move the camp here on the morrow, where our men can readily assail the foe with missiles from above?"
The eyes beneath the sorcerer's cowl were veiled in purple darkness, but the prince fancied that they glowed deep in that cavernous hollow, like the night eyes of beasts of prey. Thulandra purred,
"My lord prince,
If the demons I unleash perform their proper function, my spell would put your men in danger should they stand where we stand now. The final stage I shall commence at midnight, a scant 3 hours hence. Xiao will inform you in good time.
The magician shook more powder into the steaming pot and stirred the molten mixture with a slender silver rod.
Now I crave your pardon, good my lord, but I must ask you to stand back whilst I construct my pentacle.
Xiao handed Thulandra Thu the wooden staff, ornately carved, which served him as a walking stick when he stalked about the camp. While his servant piled fresh fuel upon the dying fire, the sorcerer paced off certain distances about the conflagration and marked the bare earth with the ferrule of his staff. Muttering, he drew a circle, a dozen paces in diameter, then etched deep lines back and forth across the space enclosed. Following an arcane ritual, he inscribed a symbol in each angle of the pentacle. The prince understood neither the diagram nor the lettering thereon, but felt no desire to plumb the wizard's unholy mysteries. Now Thulandra rose up and stood beside his fire, his back to the precipice. He intoned an utterance, a prayer or incantation, in a sing-song foreign tongue. Then, facing east, he repeated his invocation, and in this wise completed one rotation. Numitor saw the stars grow dim, and shapeless shadows flutter through the clear night air. He heard the sinister thunder of unseen beating wings. Thinking it better not to view more of the uncanny preparations of his cousin's favorite, he stumbled back to camp. To his captains he gave orders to rouse the men an hour before midnight to comply with the sorcerer's directions. Then he turned in. 3 hours later, Xiao spoke to a sentry, who sent another to awaken the sleeping prince. As Numitor made his way to the cliff whereon the wizard prepared his magical spell, he came upon the column of soldiers ordered by Thulandra Thu. Each man-at-arms gripped a bound and captive satyr. A dozen of the furry forest folk whimpered and wailed as their captors brutally hustled them into line. Xiao had built up the fire, and the brazen pot bubbled merrily, sending a cloud of varicolored smoke into the starlit sky. Upon Thulandra's curt command, the first soldier in the line dragged his squirming captive to the copper cauldron standing upon the grass and forced the bleeding creature's head down over the vessel's rim. As the darkness throbbed to the beat of an inaudible drum, or was it the beat of the awestruck soldiers' hearts, the sorcerer deftly slashed the satyr's throat. At a signal, the man-at-arms lifted the sacrificial victim by its ankles and drained its blood into the large container. Then, in obedience to a low command, he tossed the small cadaver over the precipice. A pause ensued, while Thulandra added more powders to his sinister brew and pronounced another incantation. At length, he beckoned to the next man in line, who dragged his satyr forward to be slain. The other soldiers shifted uneasy feet. One muttered, "This takes longer than a coronation. Would he get on with it and let us back to bed?" The eastern sky was paling when the last satyr died. The fire beneath the brazen pot had burned to a bed of embers. Xiao, at his master's command, unhooked the steaming pot and poured its boiling contents into the blood-filled cauldron. The nearest soldiers saw, or thought they saw, ghostly forms rise from the latter vessel, but others perceived only great clouds of vapor. In the deceptive pre-dawn half-light, none could be sure of what he saw. Faintly in the distance, those on the cliff-top heard the sound of men in motion. Among the marching men no word was spoken, but the jingle of harness and the tramp of many feet cried defiance to the silent morning air. Thulandra Thu raised a voice shrill with tension.
"My lord! Prince Numitor! Order your men away!"
Startled out of his sleepy lethargy, the prince barked the command.
"Stand to arms! Back to camp!"
The sounds of an approaching army grew. The sorcerer raised his arms and droned an invocation. Xiao handed him a dipper with which he scooped up liquid from the cauldron and poured the fluid into a deep crack in the rocks. He stepped back, raised imploring arms against the lightning sky, and cried out again in unknown tongues. Then he ladled out another dipperful and another. Along the road from Kulario, before that sandy ribbon disappeared beneath a canopy of leaves, the mage could see a pair of mounted men. They trotted towards the giant's notch, and as they went they studied the rock wall and the woods below it. Then a whole troop of cavalry came into view, and following them files of infantry, swinging along with weapons balanced on their shoulders. Thulandrathu hastily ladled out more liquid from the cauldron, and once more raised his skinny arms to heaven. Leading the first rank of rebel horse, Conan rose in his stirrups to peer about. His scouts had seen no royalists in the greenery along the forest road, or at the giant's notch, or atop the towering cliffs. The Cimmerian's eagle glance raked the summit, now tipped a rosy pink by the slanting rays of the morning sun. Conan's apprehension of hidden traps stirred in his savage soul. Prince Numitor was no genius, this he knew, but even such a one as he would make ready to defend the notch. Yet he saw no sign of a royalist mustering. Would Numitor indeed allow the rebels to reach the Imerian plateau to lessen the odds against them? Conan knew the nobles of this land professed obedience to the rules of chivalry, but in all his years of war no general had ever risked a certain chance of victory for such an abstract principle. Nay, the enemy had the upper hand. A trap was obvious. Experience with the hypocrisies of civilized men made the Cimmerian cynical about the ideals they so eloquently proclaimed. The barbarians among whom he had grown to manhood were quite as treacherous, but they did not seek to gild their bloody actions with noble sentiments. One scout reported a strange discovery. At the base of the escarpment, leftward of the giant's notch, he had come upon a heap of satyr corpses, each with its throat ripped open. The bodies, smashed and scattered, had fallen from the heights above.
"Sorcery afoot," muttered Trosuro. "The king's he-witch has joined with Numitor, I'll wager."
As the two lead horsemen neared the notch, they spurred their steeds and vanished up the road that paralleled the turgid river by Taxa. Soon they reappeared upon a rocky ledge and signaled all was quiet. Conan scanned the summit once again. He thought he caught a hint of movement, a mere black speck that might have been a trick of light or of tired eyes. Turning, he motioned the leader of the troop, Captain Morenus, to enter the tunnel of the notch. Conan sat his mount beside the road, watching intently. As the horsemen trotted past, his heart swelled at the soldierly appearance they made, thanks to the driving force of his incessant drilling. His own horse, a bay gelding, seemed restless, stamping its hooves and dancing sideways. Conan stroked the creature's neck to gentle it, but the bay continued to fidget. He first thought the animal was impatient to move forward with the others of the troop, but as the horse became more agitated, a premonition took shape in Conan's mind. After another glance at the escarpment, Conan, a scowl on his scarred face, swung off his beast and dropped with a clash of armor to the ground. Gripping his reins, he shut his eyes. His barbarian senses, keener than those of city-bred men, had not deceived him. Through the soles of his boots he felt a faint quivering in the earth. Not the vibration that a group of galloping horsemen sends through the ground. This was something slower, more deliberate, with more actual motion, as if the earth had waked to yawn and stretch. Conan hesitated no longer. Cupping his hands around his mouth and filling his great lungs, he bellowed,
"Morenus, come back! Get out of the notch! Spur your horses all! Come back!"
There was a moment of confusion in the notch as the command was passed along and the soldiers sought to turn their steeds on the narrow way. Above them, on the cliff, the sorcerer shrieked a final invocation and struck the rocks outside his pentacle with his curiously carven staff. A rumble, a deep-toned roll that scarcely could be heard, issued from the earth. Above the retreating cavalrymen, the cliff swayed. Pieces of black basalt detached themselves and toppled with deceptive slowness, then faster and faster, striking ledges, shattering and bounding off to crash into the gorge. From the river by Taxa, towering jets of spray fountained aloft to dwarf the downward fall of the cascade. Conan found his stirrup with some difficulty as his terror-stricken beast danced around him in a circle. His foot secured, he swung cursing into the saddle and wheeled to face the column of infantry, still marching briskly towards the notch.
"Get back! Get back!" he roared,
but his words were lost in the grumbling, grinding thunder of the earthquake. He moved his horse into the column's path, making frantic gestures. The lead men understood and checked their gait, but those behind continued to press forward so that the column bunched up into a milling mass. Within the notch, the cliff swayed, reeled, and crumbled. With the roar of an angry god, millions of tons of rock cascaded into the gap. The earth beneath the soldiers' feet so swayed and bounced that men clutched one another to stay erect. A few fell, their weapons clattering to the rocky ground. Down from the deadly flume raced Conan's troop of cavalry, lashed by their panic. The leaders crashed into the infantry column, drowning some horses, spilling riders from their saddles, and injuring many foot soldiers caught in the pincers' jaws. Men's shouts and horses' screams soared above the thunder of the quake. The Bitaxa River foamed out of its bed as waves sent downstream by the fall of rock spread out on the flatlands below and lapped across the road. Soldiers splashed ankle-deep in water and prayed to their assorted gods. Controlling his frantic mount by a savage grip on the reins, Conan sought to restore order.
"Marinus!" he shouted. "Did all your men get out?" "All but a dozen or so in the van, General."
Glowering at the giant's notch, Conan cursed the loss. A vast cloud of dust obscured the pass until a wind sprang up and swept it out. As the dust thinned, Conan saw that the notch was now much wider than before, and that its slopes were less than vertical. The flume was filled with a huge talus of broken rock, stones of all sizes, from pebbles to fragments as large as a tent. From time to time, small slides continued to issue from the sloping walls and clatter down upon the talus. Any man caught beneath that fall of rock would be entombed forever. One section in the left side of the cliff had curiously remained in place. It now rose from the slope like a narrow buttress. At the pinnacle of this strange formation, Conan saw a pair of small figures, black-robed and cowled. One tossed its arms on high, as if in supplication.
"That's the king's sorcerer, Thulandrathu, or I'm a Stygian," rasped a voice nearby.
Conan turned to see Grommel at his elbow.
"Think you he sent the earthquake?" "Aye, and if he'd waited till we were all within the notch, we'd all be dead. He's too far for a bow shot, but if I had a bow, I'd chance it."
An archer heard and handed up his bow, saying,
"Try mine, sir."
Grommel dismounted, drew an arrow to the head, shifted aim by a hair's breadth, and let fly. The arrow arced high and struck the cliff a score of paces below the top. The small figures vanished.
"A good try," grunted Conan. "We should have set up a ballista. Grommel, there are broken bones in need of splints. See that the physicians do their work."
Under lowering brows, Conan stared at the talus. His barbarian instincts told him to rally his men, dismount the cavalry, and lead them all in a headlong charge up the steep incline, leaping from rock to rock with naked steel in hand. But experience warned him that this would be a futile gesture. Throwing away men's lives to no good purpose, progress would be slow and laborious. The struggling climbers would be raked by arrows from above. Those who survived the climb would be too winded to do battle. He looked around.
"Ho there! Prospero! Prospero! Marinus, send a trooper to tell Publius and Palantides that I want them here."
"Now, friends, what next?"
Count Prospero reined his horse closer to Conan's and studied the mass of broken rock.
"The army can in no way ascend the slope. Men afoot might slowly pick their way up if Numitor did not assail them and the sorcerer cast no other deadly spell. But horses, never. Nor yet the wains."
Could we build our own road, replacing the rock ledge path that lies beneath the rocks, suggested Prospero.
Prospero considered the idea.
With 1,000 workmen, several months, and gold to spare, I'd build you as fine a road as you could wish.
We do not have such time, nor money either, rumbled Conan. If we cannot go through the notch, we must go over, under, or around it.
Order the men to march a quarter league back along the road and pitch camp under the forest trees.
In the royalist camp, Thulandrathu confronted a furious prince. The exhausted sorcerer, looking much older than was his wont, leaned on Xiao's sturdy shoulder. The area on which his pentacle was marked had not fallen with the balance of the cliff, and he had walked the narrow bridge to safety.
"You fool necromancer," grumbled Numitor. "Since you would resort to magic, you should have waited till the notch was filled with rebels. Thus we had slain them all. Now they have fled with little scathe."
"You do not understand these matters, prince," replied Thulandra coolly. "I withheld the final step of the enchantment until I saw that something or someone had warned the rebel leader of the trap and the rebels had begun to flee. Had I withheld my hand the longer, they would have all escaped scot-free. In any case, the flume is blocked. The rebels must needs march east to the Korotas or west to the Alamein, for they cannot now breach the escarpment. And now, your highness must excuse me. The spell has drained my psychic forces, and I must rest."
"I never did think much of miracle mongers," growled Numitor as he turned away.
In the sheltered forest camp that evening, Conan and his officers reviewed a map.
"To bypass the escarpment," said Conan, "we must return to the village of Padassa, whence the roads depart for the two rivers. But that's a lengthy march."
"If there were some little-known break in the long cliff wall," said Prospero wistfully, "we could, by moving quietly through the woods, steal a march on Numitor and fall upon him unawares."
Conan frowned.
"This map shows no such pass. But long ago I learned not to trust map-makers. You're lucky if they show the rivers flowing in the true direction. Prospero, know you any alternate route?"
Prospero shook his head.
"Nay. There must be streams other than the Bitaxa that cut a channel in the cliff."
Prospero shrugged helplessly. Palantides entered, saying,
"Your pardon, General, but two men of Serticus's company have deserted."
Conan snorted.
"Every time we win, men desert from the royalists to join us. Every time we lose, they desert us for the king. It is like a game of chance, following fate's decree. Send scouts to look for them and hang them if you catch them, but do not make a public matter of it. Order woodsmen at dawn to study the cliff face in both directions for the distance of a league to see if they can find a pathway to the top. And now, friends, leave me to ponder further on the matter."
Beside his camp bed, Conan brooded over a flagon of ale. He restudied the map and cudgeled his brain for a way his army might surmount the escarpment. Absently, he fingered the half-circle of obsidian, which once had hung between the opulent breasts of the dancing girl Alcina, and which was now clasped around his massive neck. He stared down at the object, thinking how right had been his friend Trocero's suspicion that she had caused the death of old Amulius Procas. Little by little, the pieces of the puzzle fitted together. Alcina had been sent, either by the king's spymaster or by the royal sorcerer, to try to murder him. Later, she succeeded in slaying General Procas. Why Procas? Because with Conan in his grave, Procas was no longer needed to defend Aquilonia's mad king. Hence, neither she nor her master knew, at the time of Procas's death, that Conan had recovered from her deadly elixir. Well, thought Conan, not without bitterness, he must hereafter be more cautious in choosing his betmates. But why should Procas die? because Alcina's master, whoever he might be, wanted the old man out of his way. This thought led Conan to Thulandra Thu, for the rivalry between the sorcerer and the general for the king's favor was notorious. Conan gripped the ebon talisman as this enlightenment burst upon him, and as he did so he became aware of a curious sensation. It seemed that voices carried on a dialogue within his skull. A shadowy form took shape before his eyes. As Conan tensed to snatch his sword, the vision solidified, and he saw a female figure sitting on a black wrought iron throne. The vision was to some extent transparent. Conan could dimly see the tent wall behind the image, and too nebulous to recognize the woman's features. But in the shadowy face burned eyes of emerald green. With every nerve a-tingle, Conan watched the figure and hearkened to the voices. One was a woman's dusky voice, and her words followed the movements of the shadow's lips. The voice was Alcina's, but she seemed unaware of Conan's scrutiny. The other voice was dry, metallic, passionless, and spoke Aquilonian with a sibilant slur. Conan had never exchanged a word with Thulandra Thu, although he had seen the mage across the throne room during courtly functions in Tarantia when he was general to the king. But from descriptions of the wizard, he imagined the king's favorite would speak thus. The voice proceeded.
I know not who betrayed my plan, but some treacher must have forewarned the rebel chieftain.
Alcina replied, Perhaps not, master. The barbarian pig has senses keener than those of ordinary men. He might have detected the coming cataclysm by some stirring of the air above the earth. What do you now?
I must needs remain here to guard that ninny Numitor against some asinine misjudgment until Count Ulrich arrives. The stars inform me of his coming in 3 days' time. Yet I am weary. Calling up the spirits of the earth has prostrated me. I can work no further spells until I recoup my psychic forces.
Then pray, come back forthwith, urged the vision of Alcina. Ulrich will surely arrive before the rebels can surmount the cliffs, and I have need of your protection.
Protection? Why so?
His maggoty majesty the king importunes me constantly to join him in his bestial amusements. I am afraid.
What has this walking heap of excrement been urging you to do?
His desires beggar all description, master. At your command, some men I have lain with and some I have slain, but this I will not do.
Satan Kali, exclaimed the dry male voice. When I have finished with Numenides, he'll wish he were in hell. I shall set forth for Tarantia on the morrow.
Have a care that you fall not into rebel hands along the way. Insurgent bands have been reported along the Road of Kings, and the barbarian pig might lead a swift raid into loyal territory. He is a worthy adversary.
The male voice chuckled faintly. Fear not for me, my dear Alcina, even in my present depleted state. I can, with my peculiar power, slay any mortal at close quarters. And now, farewell.
The voices fell silent, and the vision faded. Conan shook himself like one awakening from a vivid dream. With Thulandra gone from the scene of battle, and Ulrich not yet arrived, he had a chance to fall on Numitor's army and rout it. If only he could reach the plains above before the Count of Rahman came with reinforcements. He needed air to clear his rampant thoughts, and rose to leave his narrow sleeping quarters. In the adjacent section of the tent, the bodyguards whom Prospero had assigned him were so engrossed in a game of chance that none looked up as Conan, soundless as a shadow, glided past them. Outside, the sentries, used to his night prowls, supposed that he was making an inspection. They saluted as he wandered to the edge of the encampment and continued into the nighted woods. Prospero, he thought with a grim smile, would be perturbed to know that Conan once again had given his bodyguards the slip. He fumbled in his wallet for the bone whistle Gola had given him, retrieved it, and fingered it.
The satyr had said that if he ever wanted help from the people of these woods, he had but to blow upon it. Half in jest, he put the tiny whistle to his lips and blew. Nothing happened. More urgently, he blew another silent blast. Perhaps the remnant of the satyrs had departed from the scene of their destruction. Even if they heard the call, they might need time to come to him. Conan stood motionless, with the wary patience of a crouching panther waiting for its prey, listening to the buzz and chirp of insects and the rustle of a passing breeze. Now and then he put the soundless whistle to his lips and blew again. At length he felt a movement in the shrubbery.
"Who you blow whistle called satyr?" asked a small high-pitched voice in broken Aquilonian.
"Gola?"
"Nay, me Zudik, chief. Who you?"
The shrubbery parted.
"Conan the Sumerian. Do you know Gola?"
Conan, whose eyes had adjusted to the darkness, could see this was a bent and ancient satyr, whose pelt was tinged with silver.
"Aye," replied the satyr chieftain. "He tell about you.
Save him and four others.
What you want?"
"Your help to kill the men atop the cliff."
"How Zudik help big man like you?"
"We need a pathway to the top," said Conan, "now that the giant's notch is filled with rocks. Know you another way?"
The night sang with the sound of insects in the silence. Then Zudik answered slowly,
"Is small path that way?"
The satyr pointed eastward.
"How far?"
The satyr replied in his own language, and his words were like the caws of crows. Puzzled, the Sumerian asked,
"Can we get there within a day's march?"
"Walk hard, can do."
"Will you show us the way?"
"Aye, be ready before sunup."
Later, Conan sought out Publius and said,
"We move at dawn for a path the satyrs say leads to the bluff, but it's too narrow for the wagons. You will take the baggage train back to Pedassa and follow the road thence to the Korotas. If we join you on the road to Tarantia, we shall have vanquished Numitor. If not," Conan drew a finger across his throat, "you'll go alone."
The second gap in the escarpment was much narrower than the giant's notch. From below it was invisible, hidden by lush greenery and overhanging rocks. The horsemen had to lead their mounts across the brook that gurgled at the bottom of the cleft and up the rocky way. More than one horse, frightened by the narrowing canyon walls, held up the others while it whinnied, rolled frightened eyes, and reared. The men afoot, walking in single file, could just squeeze through. When dusk made the path darker and more sinister, Conan urged each man to grasp the garments of the man ahead and stumble forward. Morning saw the last man through. While the Army of Liberation rested from their forced march and arduous climb, Conan sent scouts to probe Numitor's position. On their return, the leader reported,
"Numitor has struck his camp and fallen back for several leagues along the road. His men have pitched camp in the forest, straddling the highway."
Conan looked a question at his officers.
Palantides said, "What's this? Even if Numitor is stupid, I've never heard he was a coward." "More likely," Trocero put in, "he learned that we have found a way up the escarpment and feared we would drive him to the precipice." "The sorcerer might have warned him," ventured Prospero.
"That is not all, General," said the chief scout. "Four more regiments have arrived to reinforce the enemy. We recognize their banners."
Conan grunted. "Numitor has stripped the Westermark of regulars, leaving the defense against the Picts to the local militia. So we are again outnumbered, and the royal frontiersmen are skillful fighting men. I fought beside them, and I know." He paused a moment, then added,
"Friends, that satyr Gola said something about using pipes against a foe. What think you that he meant?"
None knew. At last Conan said,
"I see I must consult our little folk again."
As dusk drew a gray veil of mist along the tumbling stream,
Conan worked his way down the narrow path up which his men had so laboriously clambered. He stood alone in the enshrouding dark of the Broselian forest, listening in vain for any footfall. He blew on the bone whistle, and as before, he waited in the shadow of an ancient tree. When at last his call was answered, he was relieved to find it was Zudik, the satyr who had directed his army to the pass. In answer to a question, Zudik said,
"Aye, we use pipes. Make your men stop up ears."
"Plug up our ears?" asked Conan wonderingly.
"Aye. Use beeswax, cloth, clay, so can no longer hear. Then we help you."
Numitor's frontiersmen lay in a crescent across the highway to Tarantia. The prince seemed prepared to stand on the defensive until the arrival of Count Ulrich. His men were digging earthworks with implanted pointed stakes to impede an attacker. Because of the dense stands of trees, the rebels could not outflank the royalists' long line. Silently, the Army of Liberation spread out before the crescent, their presence hidden by the shrubbery. But when a royal sentry perceived a movement in the bushes, he sounded an alarm. Men dropped their shovels, snatched weapons, and took positions on the line. Conan signaled to his aides, whose ears were plugged, to tell the archers to ply the foe with arrows, and presently the thrum of bowstrings and the whistle of arrows rent the air. But Conan's men heard nothing. To the royalist defenders on the ends of the line came a chilling sound, a shrill, ululating, unearthly piping. It came from nowhere into everywhere. It made men's teeth ache and imbued them with a strange, unreasoning panic. Soldiers dropped their weapons to clutch at pain-racked heads. Some burst into hysterical laughter. Others dissolved in tears. As the sound drew nearer, the feeling of dire doom expanded until it overflowed their souls. The impulse to be gone, which at first they mastered, overcame their years of battle training. Here and there a man turned from his position on the line to run, screaming madly to the rear. More joined the flight until the outer limits of the line dissolved into a mass of terrified fugitives, running from they knew not what. As the prince's flanks were swept away, the unseen pipers moved towards the center, until that too disintegrated. Trocero's cavalry rode down the fleeing men, slaying and taking prisoners. "Anyway," said Conan as he looked at the abandoned royalist camp, "they left us weapons enough for twice our number. So now we can recruit whatever volunteers we find." "That was an easy victory," exulted Prospero.
"Too easy," replied Conan grimly.
"An easy victory is oft as false as a courtier's smile. I'll say the road to Tarantia is open when I see the city walls, and not before."
Chapter 11. The Key to the City. The Army of Liberation tramped unopposed through the smiling land, where Poitain's herds of fine horses and cattle grazed on luxuriant grass, and castles reared their crenellated towers of crimson and purple and gold. The rebel army serpentined its way through pillow-rounded mountains, lush with vegetation, and at last approached the border between Poitain and the central provinces of Aquilonus. End of Side 4. Change side selector switch. This book is continued on the next cassette.